From the KBIA newsroom in Columbia, I'm Sarah Shariari, and this is Intersection on KBIA. Last week, Missouri Governor Eric Greitens was indicted by a grand jury and charged with felony invasion of privacy. His trial is scheduled to begin on May 14th. But what is a grand jury, an indictment, or a felony? And for that matter, what is invasion of privacy? In this special to Intersection, we talk with MU Law Professor Ben Trachtenberg. He helps us break those words down so we can understand more about what the indictment really means.
So my first question for you is, what is a grand jury?
So a grand jury is one of the ways that a person can be charged with a crime. In the United States, if you go look it up in the Constitution, you'll see that people are not allowed to be prosecuted unless they are indicted by a grand jury. And it may be a little bit confusing because you might hear that people are prosecuted without being indicted by a grand jury. And what the Supreme Court has said is that in state court, you either need a grand jury or some fair equivalent of the grand jury. So sometimes you'll hear that someone was indicted after a preliminary hearing. That's where the prosecution went to a judge and showed some evidence to the judge. And so to back up, though, why have any of this? The idea is that people shouldn't be put through the hassle, the expense, the risk of a criminal prosecution without some group of people, such as citizens on a grand jury, deciding that the prosecution has put forward enough evidence that we'll call it probable cause. There has to be probable cause to believe the person committed the offense. Otherwise, she shouldn't have to stand trial at all. And in order to show that there's probable cause, you don't have to prove the case. A prosecutor just has to show that there's enough evidence for what's sometimes called a reasonable belief of guilt, which is nothing like proving it beyond a reasonable doubt at a real trial.
So when a prosecutor wants to charge somebody with a crime, they can either go before a judge and try to convince the judge that the person should be charged, or they can convene a grand jury and get the grand jury to indict?
Correct. And the reason that you more commonly hear about grand juries in many situations is that the grand jury has another purpose, which is the gathering of evidence. Mm. So if you are the prosecutor and you're wondering if someone committed a crime, one thing you can do is bring witnesses in front of the grand jury and ask them to tell you what they know. Of course, the prosecutor could have police officers interview these witnesses at home or wherever, but most people know better. They don't have to talk to police if they don't want to. But if the grand jury subpoenas you to come talk, you have to, unless you have some privilege, like you might incriminate yourself or something like that. But if you're just some witness and the grand jury says show up, then you have to show up.
Or go to jail.
In theory, go to jail if the judge holds you in contempt. That's right.
So in this case, we have the grand jury convened in St. Louis. Why was it in St. Louis in this case and not in, I don't know, Jefferson City or some sort of federal court? Why is it in that city?
Well, it wouldn't be in federal court because this is a state crime. And so state crimes are prosecuted in state court, federal crimes in federal court, and that's it. The reason that it's the circuit court in St. Louis City as opposed to anywhere else is that's where the actions in the indictment are said to have occurred.
Great. So it's completely tied to like where things happened.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with where Eric Greitens lives or where he'd want to be tried.
Got it. And what does a prosecutor have to do to get that grand jury together? I imagine they have to convince somebody that it's worthy of convening the grand jury.
Well, in large cities, grand juries are pretty much working all the time. Mm. So in St. Louis City, presumably St. Louis County, certain of the counties in the Kansas City area, you're going to have grand juries that are readily available because there's lots of people who need indicting at any given time, and the prosecutors are going to come in with their evidence. And indeed, we think sometimes of a grand jury that's working on one case, but in reality, grand juries are often working on case after case after case, just like you could get called for jury duty for a regular criminal trial or a civil trial involving a car accident or whatever other lawsuit. You can get called for grand jury service. And that means you hang out at the courthouse for a month.
That sounds terrible.
That is the way many people react to being called for grand jury service. It is, I would imagine, quite educational in that you get a real slice of what's going on in the
yes.
county. I've never done grand jury service myself.
So this is not, you know, a long, often not a long, drawn out process like an entire trial would be. It's, you know, they see the information and they make a decision about whether a reasonable person could think that this could have happened or that it did happen.
Exactly. Often a grand jury presentation would only have one witness. So, for example, if someone's being indicted for felonious possession of a firearm or something like that, a gun he's not supposed to have, they could have a police officer come in and say, I arrested this guy. When I patted him down, I pulled out this gun. That's the case.
That's that. Of course, in this case, we don't know how many witnesses they had come in at this time, I think.
Well, we get a little bit of a hint because if you look at the indictment, it says on it under witnesses, KS, PS, and JW. So it's possible that those are the three witnesses.
Right.
But I don't know who they are.
Yeah. And so a grand jury is just like any other jury of people called in for jury duty, like people from that area who have.
These would be people who live in St. Louis City. You can't be on a jury for a jurisdiction in which you don't live.
And they're not like special jurors because it's a grand jury. They're just like regular old jurors for any other.
They're like regular old jurors. They have to be the right age. They have to be citizens of the United States and so on. But other than that, they don't need special training or qualifications.
This is Intersection on KBIA. In this special episode, we're talking with MU Law Professor Ben Trachtenberg to better understand the indictment of Missouri Governor Eric Greitens for felony invasion of privacy.
And when we look at the language in the indictment, some of it is the indictment states this is a Class D felony for invasion of privacy in the first degree. So I'd just like to sort of parse that and break that down. What is a Class D felony?
Sure. So for all crimes, there's two questions. One is, did this person do this crime? And the other is, how bad a crime are we talking about? So if you're trying to figure out what kind of punishment someone should get, you need to know how serious an offense that we're dealing with. So in jurisdictions that have felonies and misdemeanors with names like Class A, Class B, Class C, usually Class A is going to be the worst. And so the higher you go in the alphabet, the less terrible a felony you're talking about. And then eventually you get into misdemeanor land. So the state of Missouri reorganized its penal code not very long ago. So now you have Class E felonies as the lowest level of felony. And then next to that would be a Class A misdemeanor and so on. So here you have a Class D felony because this is an allegation that Governor Greitens committed this offense in 2015, which is before the reorganization of the penal code for the state. So if you go and look up right now, you see it's RISMO, which is what people refer to as the Revised Statutes of Missouri. RISMO section 565.252. If you go look that up today, you'll see something that refers to a Class E felony or perhaps a misdemeanor, depending on whether certain aggravating factors can be proven. But this says Class D felony because they're trying him on the basis of what was the law in force on or about March 21, 2015, which is the date specified in the indictment.
And we have in the first degree. So are degrees like the letters in that?
Similar.
Higher or like closer to the beginning is worse.
Right. First degree murder is worse than second degree murder.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go and look further down into the penal law, you might discover for certain offenses, there's first degree, there's second degree, and so on.
Could you tell us a little bit about invasion of privacy? What is that? You know, is it like you mistakenly look in somebody's window while you're walking by their house at night, or what constitutes that?
Sure. So the phrase invasion of privacy can mean different things in different contexts. The same words might mean one thing in Connecticut and another thing in California and a third thing in Missouri. It can have relevance in a criminal case like the one with the governor, or in civil cases, you might be able to sue someone for invasion of privacy depending on what they've done and where you live and what the law is. So rather than try to give you a sort of sweeping idea of what it could mean anywhere, I'll just talk about the statute that we have here. And again, I'm talking about the one that was in force in 2015. So to commit invasion of privacy in the first degree, you have to do a certain number of things that are known as elements. The elements are the little parts that the prosecution has to prove. You know, it's like a brick and they have to build a wall. You need the whole wall or you don't get the conviction. So you have to show that someone has knowingly photographed or filmed another person. That's the first element. You didn't do it by accident. You filmed them or photographed them on purpose. then it has to have been done without their knowledge and consent. So, of course, people volunteer to be photographed all the time. No one's breaking the law if they take a picture of their friend with permission. The third element is that the person being photographed is in a state of full or partial nudity. So you cannot violate this statute by taking a picture of someone who's fully dressed, even if you sneak up behind them without their knowledge and take the picture, because we understand that it's a more serious invasion of your privacy if you're naked than if you're dressed. And then you have to be in a place where one would have a reasonable expectation of privacy. And I'm going to come back to that one in a minute because that's the one the governor's lawyers are fighting about in the court already.
Mm.
And then in the older version of the statute, the last element is that you, the photographer or the filmer or whoever did this, has to subsequently distribute the photograph or film to another person or transmit it in a way that it can be accessed by a computer. So if, for example, you had an old-timey film camera and you took a picture and you didn't give it to anybody, you wouldn't violate the statute. But if you gave the picture to your friend or you scanned it or took a picture of it and texted it even to yourself, then it would be accessible by a computer. I think nowadays if you take a picture with a phone that also does your email, it may be that pretty much the mere existence of the picture on your iPhone or your Android phone is in a manner that allows access. But it might be argued that you haven't transmitted it yet. And I'll be interested to see what the exact facts are proven in this case.
Right, because, I mean, if you have your smartphone, your phone could be uploading things to the cloud. That doesn't mean you purposely distributed it, but it certainly did become accessible in a wider way.
Correct. And it doesn't say that you purposely distributed it. It just says that you distributed it.
Mm-hmm.
The mental term there, the so-called culpable mental state, is knowingly photographed. So if you photograph someone knowingly, in other words, you do it on purpose, you meant to do it, then this is going to kick in.
This is Intersection on KBIA. In this special episode, we're talking with MU Law Professor Ben Trachtenberg to better understand the indictment of Missouri Governor Eric Greitens for felony invasion of privacy.
And so I want to go back now to the reasonable expectation of privacy. And I'll just give two examples of where you obviously do and you obviously don't. And then we can talk about this case.
Mm-hmm.
If some person is walking down the street and takes off his clothes, and another person is standing nearby and says, look at this ridiculous scenario, and takes a photograph, there has not been an invasion of anyone's privacy. If you don't want people to see you naked, you probably shouldn't be walking around naked on a public street.
Right.
Similarly, I'm sorry, now, by contrast, if you're in your house and some person is in a tree across the street and points a telephoto lens through your bathroom window and takes a picture of you stepping out of the shower, you clearly were in a place where you had a reasonable expectation of privacy. And so those cases are easy. Someone who hides a camera in a tanning bed at the salon is clearly putting the camera where somebody has a reasonable expectation of privacy. So the question in this case is, what if you go to someone's basement and have consensual sex? You know that you're naked. You know that person can see you, but you don't know he's taking your picture.
Mm.
The governor's lawyers have argued in a motion to dismiss the indictment that the woman in this story, if the photograph took place at all, which of course the governor is not yet admitting, but it seems hard to believe that this indictment would have come down if there is no photograph in the hands of the prosecutors. We shall see.
Mm-hmm.
But the governor's lawyers are saying, even if a photograph was taken, this woman was not in a place where she had a reasonable expectation of privacy. After all, she knew she was naked and there was a man in the room. I think this argument is going to be a tough one for the governor's lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think there's a big difference between consenting to be seen by your intimate partner and consenting to be photographed by your intimate partner. And I don't think this is a complicated thought experiment. It's very easy to imagine that two people would be having consensual sex and one of them whips out a camera and the other one says, what do you think you're doing? It's
yes.
A different kind of consent. Or to come up with another thought experiment, remember I suggested the hidden camera in the tanning booth. Let's imagine someone hides a camera in his own room. Then he goes out to the bars and he hopes for the best. He comes home with someone and they have consensual sex and the camera is running the whole time. He hasn't committed sexual assault, but I would argue that he has committed the invasion of privacy of the person who got filmed unknowingly. Some people are happy to be filmed when they're having sex. Other people are not. You're supposed to ask.
Right. That does seem like a pretty clear line to me, at least.
Yeah, but there is some ambiguity, perhaps, in a place where one would have a reasonable expectation of privacy. You might argue that that place is somewhere where you have an expectation of privacy with respect to third parties. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of argument the governor's lawyers are making. Like I said, I think it's a tough one. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a stupid or inappropriate or silly argument. I don't think there's anything wrong with them making it from a legal point of view. But from the perspective of, do I think a bunch of Missouri judges are going to think this is how I want to interpret our state statute? I think they've got the harder side of the argument.
This is Intersection on KBIA. I'm Sarah Shariari. Since our conversation with MU Law Professor Ben Trachtenberg earlier this week, some new questions have been raised, including whether the prosecution actually has in hand the photo that Greitens allegedly took. Thank you for joining us here today on Intersection. And of course, thank you to our guest, Ben Trachtenberg. I'm Sarah Shariari for Intersection on KBIA 91.3 FM.